Hello and welcome to CWA. Today is Thursday, April 13th. The time is 12:30 p.m. and this is panel number 4456, entitled Young and Bored of Being Young and Bored. I'd like to ask you now to all silence your cell phones out of respect for our panelists and for everyone else in the audience. Additionally, in the session, we will utilize both the CWA app and the note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question on the app, simply select the session in the schedule, tap Live Q&A, and then insert your question. You may also raise your hand at any time to request a note card and pencil from one of our producers, and then give your question to the producer, who will bring it up to me so I can ask. All right, without further ado, my name is Aaron Schultz. I am a senior here at CU studying political science and am very interested in how young people get involved today. That's why I chose to be a part of this panel. So we're going to start first with our panelist, Willow Wilson. She's an award-winning author and comic book writer. She began her career during her time at Boston University, after which she moved to Cairo, which has been very influential in her career. She's tried to push the envelope on who's represented in comics, both gender and identity. And so without further ado, here's Willow Wilson.
Hello. I was very excited when I came in to see that there were so many students in the audience, not just here at Colorado University, but also from some of our local middle schools. So I'm very, very glad that you are all here, and I'm very interested to hear what kind of questions you'll want to ask when this part of the discussion is over. When I first saw this topic, I kind of was puzzled for a little bit because I said, huh, young and bored of being young and bored. Most of the people that I know who might reasonably qualify as young are the least bored people I have ever met in my life. I just spoke last week at a middle school in Brooklyn to some of the most woke 13-year-olds I have ever met, whose questions and whose thoughtfulness about what's going on in the world today really both challenged my own thinking and sort of forced me to go deeper into some of the topics that were brought up than I ever expected to. For me, the power of youth culture has been one of the most predominant influences in what I have been able to write and the audiences that I have been able to reach over the course of the past 10 years or so. When I moved to Cairo shortly after graduating from Boston University, I was quite young. I was 20. I began working as a journalist and as a kind of a stringer, somebody who doesn't officially work for any one publication but might work for several unofficially. And at the time, blogging was a very new thing over there. It was a platform through which people could talk to each other anonymously in the midst of this security state, a state which heavily regulated the press, heavily regulated what you could say on TV, on the radio, and in print. And so all the criticisms of President Mubarak, who was in power at that time, were quite muted. Everyone knew that corruption was rampant. Everyone knew that political opponents would often disappear without a trace. And yet people were generally afraid to speak up, because there wasn't a critical mass of people who would protect them if something terrible happened. So social media, which was a new thing at that point, Facebook was still a platform you could only use if you had a university-affiliated email address. Twitter was not a thing yet. But various free blogging platforms had become globally available, and you didn't have to put your name on anything. You could do it pretty anonymously. People who were enterprising could mask their identities, make it very difficult to track their ISP addresses and sort of mask where they were. And because of this, a very subtle digital pushback led primarily by very young people, these are people in their late teens and early 20s, sort of began to simmer in Egypt. And around the time of the 2005 presidential elections, the very first bloggers were arrested. They were 19 and 20 years old, and some of them are still in jail. So at that time, I was thinking, hey, this is important. Something big is going to come of this. I think that a lot of people in older generations assume that if they don't know what's going on the internet, it means that nothing is going on the internet. But in Egypt, seeing the power that these platforms had, particularly in the hands of young people, to resist authoritarianism and oppression was really stunning. But I had a hard time getting traction with that idea in the West. There were sort of dueling prejudices at work in mainstream publishing. There was a prejudice about people from the Middle East. Several well-educated editors that I talked to were shocked that internet was a thing that existed in the Middle East, and assumed, I think, on some unconscious level, that this was still a place where people rode camels to work in the morning. And on the other hand, there was also deep-seated prejudice against young people, this assumption that being on your phone, being on your iPad, being on a laptop, meant that you didn't care what was going on in the world. And I knew both of those things to be untrue. But nobody would really listen. So I wrote a novel about it instead. That became Aleph the Unseen. And sold that novel the week that Tahrir Square, the main square in downtown Cairo, was occupied to capacity by hundreds of thousands of people led by youth movements, political youth movements. These were youth movements. Some of them were socialist, some of them were democratic, some of them were religious in nature. But the leaders of these movements were almost all under 35, and many of them were under 25. So we are talking about people not far removed from their college years, and in some cases in their college years. And within 11 days, they had toppled a president who had been in power for 30 years. So I don't believe in being young and bored. None of the young people that I know who may appear bored to others are in fact deeply engaged in the world around them in ways that might not be apparent to outsiders, but in nevertheless in ways that are life-changing, that are changing the way that we talk about politics, that are changing the way that we organize. Let's not forget how the great Women's March on Washington started and some of the other movements. These are all things that coalesce around online communities or use online platforms to connect people to each other. So I, without taking up too much more time, would just like to suggest that, number one, being bored does not mean being disconnected, and being young does not necessarily mean that one is bored. And it's a common thing these days to see hot takes by people from a certain demographic in print magazines like The New Yorker and The New York Times and The Atlantic Monthly, bemoaning the fate of the world if it is left in the hands of millennials. It's a common thing to say that the world is moving forward in spite of millennials, but I would like to suggest to all of you that the world is moving forward because of them.
Our next panelist is no stranger to CU Boulder. He was formerly a professor here, Tai Toshiro, and we'd like to welcome him back to campus. He is a relationship expert who has researched the frustrations of modern relationships and also what it means to be awkward and how to harness that awkwardness to do something great.
The awkward book turned out more autobiographical than expected. A lot of junior high stories, actually, in there. And I think that actually relates a little bit to time in my life when I was pretty bored. I take a psychological perspective on a lot of things, so maybe let's start there and talk about, at least from my view, what it would mean to be bored. So boredom is like an emotion, right? It's not a very pleasant emotion. It's not very powerful, but it's just this unrest, like I should be doing something, you know? Or this is... I don't even know what the synonym would be. It just bores me, right? And it's a little bit like a seat, that annoying noise when you get in a car and you start the car and there's that buzzing sound, right? And you want that to go away. So what do? You put your seatbelt on. And that's kind of the function of boredom. The function of boredom is to say, maybe you should do something, you know, besides whatever it is you're doing. Now, that's probably a good function. I think that's actually helpful. I'm going to say that I do agree. I definitely think young people today are much more aware and much more active, I think, than my generation was. I'm a Gen Xer, and we just wore a lot of flannel and complained about the world. I think millennials are like, well, let's do something about it, which is a much better attitude to have. But I'd also say that things move pretty fast now, right? And there's a lot of things that you can do. There's a lot of ways you can occupy your time. And I think sometimes that can tilt into an area where you're too busy. I think sometimes it's actually good to be a little bit bored, just to have little pockets where there's really nothing running through your mind. You're just staring at a white wall, letting your mind wander a little bit. And psychologists actually find that when we're in these mindless states, we're actually more likely to be creative, to have breakthroughs, because random information enters our mind and combines with other thoughts we've had, and that's how creative ideas come about. So I actually encourage building in a tiny bit of boredom. And I live in New York City, which is a very fast place. And so sometimes I'll build in blocks where I have nothing. The only goal for me is to do nothing and to see what horrifying thoughts pop into my head, you know, during that time. And once in a while, I'm like, wow, that was actually a useful thought. You know, I think the times I was most bored in my life, as I look back on it, I guess, were usually followed by some of the more interesting times in my life. And I told a story last night about when I was a senior in college. I was doing student teaching at Golden High School down the road, actually. And I thought I wanted to be a social studies teacher for high school students. And I really enjoyed it. And when I graduated, or when I was about done there, they offered me the job. They said, hey, this job you've been doing, it's going to be open next year, and we'll just give it to you. Well, that's great, right? So I should take it. Well, I went on this field trip. They had this weird field trip thing where you went to the Four Corners area and you studied Native American history. But the seniors who were in this class actually got to interact, right? They actually got to experience things and go to reservations and talk to people. And at one of the reservations, they invited us to do a sweat lodge. And if you don't know what this is, it's kind of a religious sort of ceremony. And you get in the teepee, and like you're in your swimming suit, and they put a bunch of hot rocks in there. It's a very claustrophobic experience. It's like being in this tiny, tiny sauna that is incredibly hot. And you start to have these delusions, kind of, and your mind starts to, yeah, you have these weird thoughts. And I totally freaked out. And I was like, I cannot do this job. So I got out of this sweat lodge with all these high school seniors. So they're younger than me, right? And I just vocalized it. I said, I don't think I can take this job at Golden High School. I said, what should I do? You know, so a bunch of 17, 18-year-olds. And they said, dude, you should go to Mexico. I was like, okay. So that's what I did, you know? And I ended up wandering around. I wouldn't recommend this necessarily, but it was wonderful. I ended up wandering around Mexico. And there were some, you know, yeah, very bored times in my life. But I think during that time, I came across some ideas that were more bold, I think, and more adventurous than I had ever let myself entertain. And I think I would have really enjoyed being a high school teacher. I sometimes miss that I didn't take that path. But I also think I wouldn't have maybe thought of some other paths I've gone down that ended up being really rewarding. So, you know, like I said, I think young people are just, so engaged and so active and effective with a lot of things that they do, and that's a great thing. But maybe give yourself a little bit of time to every now and then be a little bit bored.
Our third speaker is Anita Sarkeesian. While still a student at York University, she launched a website called Feminist Frequency. She's one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People, and she's worked to examine and critique gender roles and gender tropes in popular culture, which hasn't always been appreciated.
That's an understatement. Hello. So I'm going to be a bit of a downer, I think, only to like add a little bit more flavor to the panel, because I completely agree with everything that was already said. And I was very confused about the topic of this panel. I was like, am I young? Am I on this panel because I'm young? Depends what group I'm in. Am I bored? Because I'm so not bored. I kind of wish I was bored. But so I want to talk about one way in which young and bored is actually young and bored and how that's detrimental. But I do want to acknowledge this really quick. Before we came over here, I was informed that the White House just announced that they dropped a bomb on Afghanistan. And this is coming off the tails of launching missiles in Syria. And it hit me really hard, and I suspect that it's hitting a lot of people really hard that we are at war again, continuing so. And I just want to acknowledge those feelings that might come up for folks that come, that have family there, that care about other people in the world, that don't want us to be in this place. So I'm happy to talk to folks about it afterwards if you want. And also, I find myself very emotional, so I wanted to preface that. Right. So here we are. And I will continue to be a downer, and then maybe we can bring some levity up. So yeah, I don't know. So I don't necessarily consider myself young in the context of like who is leading social movements today, right? Who's doing the work today? I was once a part of that, and now I'm not. And I like to make space for folks who are doing that work and acknowledge that, because I think sometimes adults get really ageist when it comes to young people, and we have a tendency to be like, oh, well, you don't know what you're talking about, or saying like, oh, well, when I was a kid, blah, 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 right? Like just all that annoying stuff that you never want to hear and that we didn't want to hear when we were adult, when we were kids either. So I totally agree with that. When I think of young and bored, though, there is a group of people that comes to mind, and those are the people who do online harassment, which I know a little bit about. And they're not all young, so I just, to dispel us of that myth, but some of them are, so I'm going to just weasel this in there. They're certainly bored. I can't even imagine how bored they are, because they have so much time to stalk women online, right? And this takes many forms, but the ones that I'm thinking about specifically are the people who like lay in bathrobes and hold a camera up to their faces and talk for 4 hours about how much they hate me. Like, who has that kind of time? I don't get it. So there's all these videos of men who kind of hate women. They hate women. They don't like that we're speaking up about feminism. They don't like that we're challenging the status quo, and they want to make it known. There's all these wacky conspiracy theories that come out of boys and men spending time in message boards online, talking to each other, and like making charts and graphs. We call them like MS Paint conspiracy theories because they look like the old school like MS Paint line drawings. And so some of it, you know, if we want to break this down a little bit, you know, I can sit here and make fun of them all day because it's sad. But really, I think that there is a lot of anger and a lot of rage and a lot of entitlement that comes from doing this kind of work, right? Spending this much time hating people who are trying to make progress. And there's an opportunity, I think, to really reflect on that if you wanted to, right? Some days I do, some days I don't. But reflect on the fact that that a lot of these people who are attacking those of us online who are trying to create change are doing it because they feel so disempowered and they feel so disillusioned with the world and all of the things that are promised to young men in terms of what they should have or shouldn't have, such as cars and women and wealth and all of these things, they're not getting, right? And so they're taking it out on us, on people who are, you know, I'm sure you've had your fair share of harassment, who they perceive as being successful or who they perceive as challenging the norms of what they believe is right, which is this very archaic idea of men being in control and being powerful, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that some of that young and bored backlash is to the people who are young and not bored and doing an enormous amount of work to create change in our society. So I'll leave it at that. I'm very curious to see what you all came to this panel wanting to talk about and think about and discuss, because I think it's very vague and broad.
Again, please feel free to ask questions using the CWA app. Also, we have producers standing around the room with note cards, so just raise your hand if you'd like a note card. You can write a question, hand it back to them, and we'll make sure that the panelists hear those questions. First, I wanted to start off. Ty, you said that people need to factor in time to be bored in order to be creative and to make change. But we've heard that there's a lot going on in this world that's sort of preventing people from being bored, the youth from being bored. There's the wars going on, the bombings in various countries. the youth responding to the changing political environment. So in some sense, many youth today aren't able to be bored. So how do you factor in time to be bored when you're responding to what's going on in the world, be it politics or military intervention? How do you respond to that and factor in time to be bored for a little bit of self, to take care of yourself?
Well, there's a sweet spot there, I guess, right? Where you don't want to be too bored so that you're needing to break down other people online, which is really, it's unbelievable how much time people have to do that sometimes. And on the other hand, you want to be overly busy so that you can't think straight, right? So there's this kind of sweet spot in the middle. I want to follow up on a point here, and I think it's that when life has gone well, I think, for me, and when life's gone well for a lot of my friends who have, you know, done things that were cool or that they wanted to do that were helpful, they use this phrase that's really, it says a lot. They say, I just want to do the work, which is, I love that phrase. And that means that you've gotten to a place where you found something you're so passionate about that just sitting there and doing that work and thinking about it is gratifying. You know, you might have a sport or friends or whoever who would fulfill that kind of category where you just enjoy being around them or you enjoy doing it, you know. And I think that's the great place to be. But if you get really passionate about something, which I imagine a lot of the people in this room are very passionate, motivated, ambitious kind of people, sometimes it's hard to shut it off. And I think we're in a phase right now that's a little bit unhelpful, where overworking yourself can be seen as a badge of honor. And it's not something you really want to buy into. And it's we have all this kind of cool psychological data that shows you can work about 8 or 9 hours a day maximum and be really concentrated and effective and good. After that, you get really sharp declines in productivity. And sometimes you even work against yourself in those extra hours. But we still have this culture where it's like, yeah, you should be working all the time, and I think that's really unhelpful.
Thank you. Would anyone like to respond?
I so strongly agree with this, the over-romanticization of working nonstop. It's something that I've really struggled with in terms of burnout. And burnout is real. And when we're talking about work or activism, it's a thing that I think we need to be super conscious of, because we want you in the movement, and you're no good to anyone if you're too tired to be in the movement or to do the work, right? And so learning how to take those breaks has been a huge part of my growth in terms of my career and my profession and valuing it. Because I realized, like, working 24 hours, 7 days a week, you're not creative. You're not interesting. You're not making good decisions. And as soon as you give yourself a little bit of space, it's shocking how much will come to you and how much levity you'll have and how your best ideas come from it. And I wonder how that's also relevant to students, right? People like students who might be working full-time and going to school full-time, or just have like a really intense course load and the pressure to get a 4.0 and the pressure to be knowledgeable on everything and be perfect, and how that affects their structures in terms of, if anyone wants to speak to this, in terms of how when they enter the workforce, they might just bring that with them and never have time, right? Never build in that space.
Relevant to that is a question from the audience about sort of workers and employers, and specifically younger workers, who do, from their employers, feel that pressure to always be working, to always be connected. So is there a middle ground that employers and employees can find to work in that time to relax?
I think that really depends on what we as a society are willing to tolerate. I think a lot of what you've just described are kind of symptoms of our current late capitalist system, in which, you know, everyone is sort of trying to squeeze the most productivity out of people for the least amount of remuneration, which becomes a self-perpetuating cycle, of course. If you're not getting paid well in one job, you're going to need to take a second job, maybe a third job. And, you know, that creates the gig economy that so many of us live in which we never really have jobs at all. We get paid per project, which means you don't really have vacations at all. A vacation for you is synonymous with unemployment. You know, I've had this face this in my own career. I had to be on deadline within 2 weeks after the births of both of my children. And I had to, in fact, hide my pregnancies from my publishers because I didn't want that to affect whether or not they gave me work, which they could legally withhold from me because I was not technically an employee. So all of those nice laws that we passed about discrimination against women as employees did not apply to me. So these are real problems that can only really be fixed with structural changes to the way that we do business and the way that we regulate business, not to get political economy about it, but, you know, there it is.
A lot of the students have been asking questions sort of in a different vein. They want to get involved, and that's where they see their boredom. So while they may be working and going to school, they still want to find ways to get involved. So how would you recommend finding ways to get involved to sort of satisfy that passion?
I mean, I'll admit, I was a very bad student here. I think my freshman year GPA was 2.2, and my sophomore year GPA was 2.4. So don't follow in my footsteps. But I was bored, too. I was super passionate, but I was like this kind of just uncaged animal thrashing around, you know, trying to look for some direction, and I really wanted an avenue to go down. But as unsettling as that was during the time when I was in my early 20s here, it was kind of a necessary step to go through. Like, that's part of the great thing about being young, is that you're supposed to try different things, and some of those things aren't going to work. So, like, I tried to be a hip-hop dancer at one point. That was a horrible idea, you know? And I should not do that. You know, another time I tried to...
I disagree.
Oh, well, you haven't... wait till you see me out on a dance floor. It's a little painful, but I appreciate the optimism. You know, I tried spoken word at some point. That was a bad idea, too. You know, it's just really bad at that. I tried different fashion things, you know. But that's part of being young. Like, I think the worst thing... I was a bad football player, too, so let's go there. I was a bad football player in junior high school, and I just want to try. Maybe I'd be good, maybe I wasn't. I wasn't. But the coach said something that actually had a really big impact to this day, actually, on me. And he said, if you forgot the play that we called in the huddle, just hit somebody. And I'm like 12 years old. I'm like, that's brilliant, you know? Because there's so many times in life, like, you know, even now, like, I'm a grown adult. Yeah? And there's times I'm like, I have no idea, you know, what I'm doing. Like, I'm on a panel, I'm like, I have no idea what I'm doing. And the thought that goes through my head is, just hit somebody, you know? just do something. And I guess that would be my advice in response to that question is, I think it's going to be a low probability that you find something that's, yeah, totally going to mobilize your passion and totally mobilize your talents. But that's part of the beauty of it. And some of this stuff comes back later to be super valuable to you. So even though I failed at spoken word and I failed at hip-hop dancing, I would return to it just 2 years ago to try to be a better writer and study poetry through hip-hop. And that ended up to be a really valuable thing to advance myself in my career. So it's okay, you know, and sometimes it's 10, 20 years later, and you're like, wow, I'm glad I went down that path that didn't turn out to be anything at the time, but much later turned out to be a valuable thing for you.
So I started being politically active on campus. I was a student organizer, and that's how that was the beginning of my trajectory into what I do now. I think that I had a lot of thoughts, and I'm forgetting them all.
Beautiful music.
I know, it's perfect timing. We'll just pause for the church bells, or the clock tower, whatever. I think that there are my whole life we've been told that, like, even my generation's been told we're apathetic and we don't care and we don't do anything and blah blah blah. And your generation is being told the same thing, but we're seeing a huge resurgence right now in political excitement, and I mean in terms of like engagement and interest and wanting to see change in the world. And it's coming out of horror, I think, in terms of being really disillusioned with the current political landscape. And what, for whatever reason it's coming out, like, great. There's so many organizations to plug into. Organizations always need volunteers. They always want to have more people involved. Start things on campus, see who's doing stuff on campus. You know, like, there are so many ways to plug in. And it might take a minute to find the people you want to plug in with, and it might take a minute to find those organizations. But, like, in the same way that you're trying to figure out what you want to do with life, like, check out many different organizations with different subject areas that you find compelling and see what they're doing and see what they're talking about. The other thing I'll say is that when I started Feminist Frequency, we primarily make videos on YouTube. And back when I started this, I did it because when I was in grad school, I thought feminism was really alienating. And I wanted to take these really hard to read texts that you had to be privileged to understand, and you had to afford to go to school to even understand them, or they were gated so that you would have to pay to have access to databases and that sort of thing. So I wanted to make it available to a larger audience and say, here, like, let's talk about feminist theory, but let's do it in a way that's, like, kind of fun, right? Like, let's talk about video games and TV shows and movies, right? Things that we can connect on, whether we connect on politics or not, whether we connect on feminism or not, we can have a conversation about Steven Universe or Game of Thrones or whatever, right? Like, you can make these connections with folks, and it turned out to work out pretty well for me. A lot of people come up to me now saying that they never consider themselves feminist, or they were openly hostile to it, and that the work that I did helped contribute to them looking into feminism more. So I say that because at the time, like, video blogging and making videos on YouTube was still fairly new. It wasn't a thing people were making a ton of money on. It wasn't a career path that people are going down as you might see now. So what is the new stuff that your generation is going to do, right? Like, what is the new ways that you're going to interact? What new tech, what new media, what new engagement is going to be the voice of your generation that you can bring to the table? Because it doesn't have to be the same things that you're already seeing now. And I think that's one of the bits of excitement and tension that happens between generations, is that new technologies and new modes of communication develop, right? Like, you know, part of the excitement of Snapchat for young people is that old people didn't know how to use them. And I include myself in that category. I opened that up and was like, I've grown up on computers and I have no idea how this works. So, like, what are those things that are going to change the world from young people up?
So in talking about the role of technology, we've seen that in Egypt, blogging was instrumental in sort of political organization. I have a question from the audience about the role of Netflix and other social media and how that plays into boredom. How does the internet and how we use it affect how involved we are, how we get involved, whether we choose to use that to topple dictatorships or harass people online?
So I think it's a complex question. I think it sort of plays into what you were saying, because there's so much going on online that the opportunities to do nothing whatsoever rapidly diminish, and we're used to being in a state of constant stimulation. In fact, I just caught myself, literally, we had just heard the clock tower strike 1 o'clock. And I thought to myself, what time is it? I'll check my phone. Like, literally just now. And as I was doing it, I was like, this is meta, and not in a good way. So I think it really speaks to the fact that we're used to that constant state of heightened emotion that comes from being able to connect to people instantly, both in positive and negative ways, to having instant access to news, and also instant access to entertainment. There's no reason to sit on a bus and do nothing now, because you just whip out your phone and you've got your unlimited data plan and you're like, I'm going to watch me some Netflix or whatever it is, or listen to podcasts. So in a sense, that's good for all of us. I think it's made all of us into kind of autodidacts. You know, we're all seeking out information and learning even when we're not in classrooms. And in that sense, it's good. In another sense, however, it makes us all kind of afraid on some level to be alone with our own thoughts. I've noticed now that we've become very focused on performing. We can't have a meal or a thought or whatever without saying, like, hey, Facebook, I just had this profound thought. And on a whole, I think that's a positive, because we live in these increasingly atomized lives where we don't actually interact with our friends as much as we might used to. And part of that is because we're working all the time, which all, you know, it all fits together. But on the other hand, it also means that we have less time to sort of decide what our priorities are. We have less time to sort of think about, okay, if I had to eliminate things from my life and focus on the things that are truly important to me, what would those things be? And what things would I get rid of? And I find this being a factor in my own life. I've only recently started to decide that I need to treat Twitter and Facebook like lunch dates during the workday. I can't be like, oh my gosh, I can't decide what comes next on the page. I'm going to check Twitter and see what's going on. That I have to stop that, because it becomes, somebody called it the other day, the ludic loop. You just keep going from one platform to the next, and you increasingly discover that you have said and done nothing. So it's finding that sweet spot. These are tools, and I think I'm very, very cautious about encouraging fear of tools simply because we don't know how to use them. I mean, let's not forget that people thought the printing press was going to herald the end of Western civilization. This is a real thing. So I'm very, very cautious of going the technophobic route and being like, oh, you know, these phones are going to destroy civilization. They're not. But like any tool, we have to be careful about how we use them.
So I have a question for Ty specifically, but very related to what you touched on and sort of being inundated with this information. The question is, the pace of society is very quick. Again, speaking about that, all access to everything on your phone. So how do you manage your time when you can easily fill your time and solve your boredom by relying on your cell phone and Facebook and Twitter? How do you find time to utilize your boredom for something beneficial rather than wasting it on social media?
I have an extremist answer on this, I'm going to say. So I don't know if this is going to work for everybody, but I think it's unusual. What I decided at some point, I got to a point in my career where I had so many emails, there was no way I could possibly answer all of them. The ding of my phone was like, I was like one of Pavlov's dogs. I would just get this fear response every time I heard the ding of my phone. And I was like, this is not good living. So I thought I need a radical change. And what I decided to do is this, is I said, well, just like you set expectations in your friendships and your relationships, in any other way in your life, I'm going to set parameters or limits on the use of technology. And so I thought, well, 7 to 11:30 is the best time of day for me to work. That's when this brain is happens to work okay. And so I put my phone away. I go to places that have no internet, and I just go offline, you know. And the first couple weeks, it was really anxiety provoking. I was like, the world's falling apart around me and I don't know it, or people are trying to reach me and I can't. But it was fine. And your friends, unless they're bad friends, will be cool with that, you know? I mean, what kind of person's like, no, you absolutely have to be available, you know, every minute from 7 to 11:30. No, you don't, right? And so, you know, I did that. At nighttime, I have a very strict rule with myself that at 9 o'clock, you know, the phone goes into sleep mode, and only if someone has an emergency can they get a hold of me. And so I've just kind of like the lunch idea. You know, you have a lunch date with your Twitter or your Facebook. I think you can do that. And I guess the other thing, point I'd make, also related to the first question, is I try to become a lot more mindful about what I click on. Because if you look at the mountains of data about what people click on Facebook or Twitter or whatever else, it is horrifying how mindless, you know, it is. And I'm totally guilty of that as well. But you see some funny cat meme and you're like, you know, just click on this, or you'll never believe what happened when, you know, click on that. And it's just garbage and makes you feel bad. Actually, it eventually makes you feel bored. And so I will, this sounds really, once again, overdone. I limit the number of clicks I get when I go online. And that is an economic strategy to make you make higher quality choices. So I'm probably overly strict with myself, but I have to say, it was a game changer for me in my life to get that under control. So I think you can feel a lot of pressure, but I think if you make the steps to set some of those limits, I think you'd be surprised at how supportive people are of you taking the first steps to do that. some support for that idea.
I sort of want to echo what you said it in passing, and I want to just put a fine point on it that like social media is just a tool like everything else. And I really love that you brought up the fear around the printing press, because so I talk a lot about social media platforms because of harassment, and usually it is about how they work to perpetuate or encourage harassment. But like, here's the thing is, everyone wants to blame and celebrate social media for everything, and it's a tool. It's not neutral. It doesn't mean that it doesn't have a position or it doesn't have a role or what have you, but it's just a tool. And I'm actually, you know, like, I agree, and I'm oversaturated online, and I, like, sometimes have to force myself to take a break, but we are also of a different generation, right? We didn't grow up with social media, which, thank God, because I don't want all of my, like, angsty live journal memories to like be reserved forever. But that's not the reality of the current generation, right? Where all of the thoughts that you have today are around forever. And that's not, I'm not even saying that as a value judgment. It's just the facts of life today. And so I think society needs to catch up to that, as opposed to us saying, how dare you do these things? Like, you might be embarrassed when you grow up about some of the things you thought. And I'm embarrassed about some of the things I thought 5 years ago, right? Where I'm considered an adult at that point. And so I think some of it is, how do we, one, I'm actually curious if this is generational in the way that we think about it, and how like younger folks feel about social media and feel about their engagement. Do they feel the same stress that we do? Or do they feel the same sort of lostness where you're like, I just sat and looked at Facebook for an hour. What? Like, how did that happen? But also that what I mean by society catching up is like, okay, so if we're going to have generations of folks putting every thought they've ever had on the internet, we now need to catch up in terms of how we engage with that. How public mistakes and public growth and public change needs to be accepted. And we need to say, cool, you made a mistake, great, you're not going to do that again, move on, apologize, et cetera, et cetera. Or, yeah, you were 16 and you thought that, I don't know, black lipstick was cool. I don't know, black lipstick is kind of cool. But, you know, like, I can't think of a good example. But, you know, I wore tube socks on my arms when I was 16. That was the thing I did that I don't currently do, right? I want to be really cognizant of, like, I wish that there were younger people on the panel to speak to that. I feel like we are talking for young people a little bit. And, like, yeah, I think our experiences are relevant, but I don't want to impose on you our generational thoughts and anxieties onto what might not even be an issue for you, right? And there's always the fear that comes from between generation to generation. I already said that. But so yeah, I think some of it is rethinking about, like, society needs to evolve and adapt to the growing change of how a culture a generation has decided to navigate a space, as opposed to old people telling you to stop doing a thing, right?
Can I just add on to that real quick? I think there's been a lot of headlines, alarmist headlines, that say social media ruining attention in young people, or social media ruining relationships. And that's just simply not true. So if you look at the balance of research on social media use and quality of life, it's not true. There's a small segment of people that use it too much, and they're miserable, but it's a small segment. And I think the most robust finding we have at this point is that if you're whatever you are in life, just as a person, you use social media to amplify that. So for example, bullies get meaner through social media. Okay, but kids who are pro-social, who are nice, actually get nicer through social media. And so I totally agree. It's just this tool. It's this mechanism. It could be used for good or bad. But I think, yeah, it can be easy to demonize the internet as the cause of all harm in the world, when in fact it also does a lot of good.
So you all touched on the theme of different or generational gaps, and I think we discussed before the panel about defining ourselves as a generation, millennials defining themselves, millennials and younger. So the question from the audience is, Do young people actually feel bored, or is that just the establishment and older generations telling them they are?
Well, wasn't this a student-made panel, a topic?
This was a student-made panel. Again, though, I think that it's still relevant because we're trying to figure out our own identity in light of everything we read in the news, from newspapers and on TV that are telling us, oh, millennials are the end of the world. We might actually start believing it.
So we're so. Flannel shirts. Yeah. Flannel shirts were the end of the world, too. Yeah.
So you do think that it's previous generation sort of...
Can we take a poll? If you feel consistently bored, if you feel bored for more than an hour, five or more times a week, could you raise your hand? We're not going to judge you.
Young.
It's just, yeah, you can be of any age.
That's not half the room.
No, I'd say it's like about what?
Three-quarters?
Oh. No, not even. It's like, what, 25%? All right, keep your hands up. Keep your hands up again, because we can't see under these lights. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So really, yeah. No, I mean, some people, but not a majority or even a plurality. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is interesting.
And I think to talk a little bit about the idea of older generations imposing their anxieties or fears on younger generations. I'm writing a magazine article right now titled "Why Your Mid-20s Are So Awkward," and it got me in a lot of the generational data. And the thing that made me mad about getting into this is that the older generations are worse sometimes than the millennials. So, take for example job engagement. And people are like, "Oh, millennials are lazy in the workplace." And if you actually look at the percentage of people who are engaged in their job, millennials are engaged at a rate of 33%, which is low. But Gen Xers are engaged at a rate of 28%. Baby boomers are engaged at a rate of 26%. Baby boomers are twice as likely to do counterproductive things at work that actually set the company back, right? And so here you're just like, millennials this, millennials that. But actually it's like, no, I'm like, my generation is doing much worse, and making these allegations. There was a study fresh off the press today showed that Gen Xers use social media more than millennials do. And they use it in a very anxious kind of way, like, did enough people like my Instagram post kind of way. Yeah, what's the narrative? Like, oh, millennials and their social media. But like we've talked about, it happens, I think, across time, right? It's easier to pick on people who are younger because they haven't gotten to a point yet where they hold the majority of the institutional power a lot of times. So it makes you an easy scapegoat.
This is a question from the audience about being bored in relation to school. A lot of school-age kids say, I'm bored. And the question is if that's about learning new material or not being able to learn new material, and if boredom has an effect on education.
Data man.
Well, yeah, I really like that question. I really like that question because I was a very bored student. And it was part my fault, I'll say, and it was part maybe the institution's fault. But, education's like anything else, right? There's people who are great, and there's people who are okay, and there's people that aren't so good. And sometimes you get a really great teacher, and, boy, you're just so engaged, right? And sometimes you get someone who's bad, and you're like, well, this is boring. I'm not interested in this. So you get that natural variability. I think the trick is to figure out, How do I take the situations that feel semi-boring to me and make those productive so I'm just not sitting here resenting having to be here? And I think that's a really hard thing to do. It's never perfect. There's still some meetings I sit in where I'm like, I feel resentful, that I have to be here, and this is super boring. But I think the change for me, this is just my opinion, I started to think about, what's this person trying to do? So... And that really opened up a whole lot of things to me. So if you think about your professor or your teacher and you think, what's this person trying to accomplish? So are they just having me memorize this list of words to torture me? And sometimes the answer is yes, okay? Sometimes the answer is yes, and they're just an ineffective teacher, and that's why they're... But no, a lot of times, though, I'd say the majority of the cases, if you think really hard about it, or if you ask them about it, you find out it's for a productive reason. And... It's like anything in life. Like, you need to understand the vocabulary of things before you start to string that together into more continuous sorts of ideas or sentences. and then you can string those together into paragraphs. But there's so many things I think sometimes that teachers do, and I'll say this as a teacher who forgets to do these things sometimes, it's so obvious to you as a teacher why people should know this, that sometimes you forget to say, hey, this is why you should put effort into knowing this, because the next step's going to require that you have this information to be able to do this. And five steps down the road, you're going to be able to do something really cool, right, that you wouldn't have been able to do with these other things that are a little more boring. And the best differentiator between people who are successful and unsuccessful, I think, besides just the talent lottery that you're born with, is deliberate practice. And it's oversimplified sometimes to say that you need to do 10,000 hours of practice, and it's kind of true, but not. Here's what deliberate practice is. People who engage in deliberate practice purposefully identify the things they don't want to do. And then they purposefully identify how they're going to overcome that. That's deliberate practice. So I think if you're a student who's bored, you know, it's easy for me to say because I'm not in class anymore, but I think the thing I'd say is, okay, this stinks. I don't like this. But is this necessary? And if the answer is yes, this teacher is a good teacher and this could be productive. Then you think about, how am I going to endure this and push through this? And if you can do that, that's a better skill than anything you learn, I think, in school.
Taking it out just a little more systemically, because that's way more practical advice than I'm about to give. I was just thinking about how, like, the structures of schooling is very archaic. That the way that we do the, like, teacher, student, sit, be quiet, listen to the lecture format is very, very old and comes from a little bit of a shady history, and which I can't exactly recount at the moment, so go look it up, unless you know. But my point in that is, you know, I was talking about how, like, I would like to see more students come to these panels, right, come to these sessions, but also, you know, you're asking students to sit through a lecture all day and then sit through more lecturing. I think that we all learn differently, and one of the things that we may or may not get out of school is that we might have different ways of engagement and different ways of learning and different ways of taking in information, and that oftentimes classrooms don't necessarily allow for that. And I would like to see more alternative forms of education, right? It's not always just lecturing and reading the books. There's so many different ways that we learn, and how do we maybe formalize that a little bit more?
So talking about a generational divide and sort of teaching yourself how to respond to the world around you, older generations typically look down on the pastimes of youth in relation to comic books and video games. So I'd love to hear more about your opinions on the role of comic books in education and video games as well, and how that relates to boredom.
Oh, man. So I've had some very interesting conversations with educators over the course of the past few years about ways that they are using comic books in the classroom as gateways to literacy for people who might not quite be interested in reading longer books or books that sort of appear more challenging because they're about this thick and you could stop a door with them. So I think for people who are more visual, who are able to get a lot of information that way, comic books can be a great educational tool. I think also they fit very neatly into our ideas of what entertainment should be. They're a very approachable medium. They're disposable in a wide sense because you get one little pamphlet every month. You know, it's got ads in it. It's much more like a magazine than it is like a book. And when you're done reading it, you can keep it if you're a collector. Or you can toss it in the recycle bin, and nobody will think less of you as they would if you maybe tossed your copy of War and Peace in the recycle bin. So in that sense, there's a great accessibility, I think, to comics that is unlike a lot of other print media. And so that's good. Video games, I kind of came quite late to. I didn't start playing video games until I was about 26 or 27, which sounds young in the grand scheme of things, but you know, when you're playing against people who've been playing video games since they were 13 and now have the reflexes of fighter pilots, you know, it's a serious deficit to start that late. And I video games are now something I do to unwind at the end of the day. I like massive multiplayer online stuff where I can get in giant pitch battles with 1,000 other people. And I get my butt kicked every single day by those people who've been playing since they were 13 because I just don't have the same fast twitch muscles that they have. So it's nice, I think, to see video games as something that kind of cut across other ways of socializing that become compartmentalized by class and geography and life experience, because you can get good at video games. Get good. I just said that. In a very different way, and it requires a very different skill set than a very different allotment of money than going to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and knowing what the heck you're looking at and stuff like that. So it's a great social leveler, I've found, when you are playing it in a multiplayer context. And not nearly as scary as I thought it would be. I started out as sort of a Roger Ebert anti-video gaming. I just assumed that it was all crass, not art, blah, 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 knowing nothing about video games. So I went through one of these, you know, revelatory experiences where you realized not only you were super wrong about something you thought you were right about, but you are one of the people that you were prepared to make fun of. So that's been my experience with video games.
Yeah, I think that I get a lot of pushback from older folks about video games because there's this notion that video games are just played by teenage boys, which is just not true. There statistically more adult women play games than teenager boys play games, which is real, right? And that's partly because the face of video games are changing. The notion of what a video game is changing. Taking a step back, my work with Feminist Frequency is very influenced by Bell Hooks, who, if you aren't familiar with, you should immediately familiarize yourself with her. She talked about how she would go into her classrooms and she would talk about issues of difference and privilege and oppression, and her students would just, their eyes would glaze over. Then she started talking about movies and TV shows, and all of a sudden they were fully connected and they fully understood these concepts, which can be difficult concepts to understand, but when you tie them to a medium in which is our common language, because pop culture is very much a common language that a society speaks together, that it's really easy to use them as educational tools without it being an education, right? You either use it in the classrooms, but we are learning from media constantly, whether we want to admit it or not. So what we're seeing reflected back to us, what we're seeing in games and TV shows and movies and comic books, become our education. And so one, it's important to hold media makers accountable for what they're making, which is why Ms. Marvel, which Willow writes, is absolutely brilliant. You should all read that. But also, I think it's just a fundamental misunderstanding of, like you were saying, you had this impression of what games are. A lot of times people jump to conclusions about things that they don't fully know or understand, and I think it's really valuable to take a step back about why you have such strong feelings about a thing, right? Like, I have very strong feelings about things, and I know why I have them, because I've spent a lot of time thinking about them, right? So, like, if you don't like video games, why? What if I told you that there's a game that came out last year that was called That Dragon Cancer, that was about a family who lost their 5-year-old son to cancer, and they made a video game about it, and it is one of the most powerful games probably ever made. Right? That totally busts open your conception of what games are and what games can do and what they can be. And you know, like, if you don't get banned on... The other thing is, like, just if you're not on the bandwagon, we're going to leave without you, because interactive media is the future of media. And we're seeing that in so many different ways. So, you know, I don't think you're going to have young people being like, we shouldn't have video games. Right?
I've gotten several questions about people who are passionate about something in relation to video games, comic books, or the world around them, and they want to know if there's something you're passionate about, how do you make a career out of it? So I'd love to hear personal stories about how you found something you're passionate about and how you turned that into a career. And the floor is open to anyone.
Well, I told the story last night. I hope I'm not repeating for anybody, but... I was kind of a peculiar child. I liked baseball, and I played baseball, and I was all right, but what I really liked was baseball statistics, which is really nerdy, but I really loved statistics, and so I would go in the paper every day, and I would look at the numbers. I have a really good memory for numbers, horrible memory for most other things in life, but really good memory for numbers. And I would sit there, and I wasn't satisfied. This is how nerdy I was. I was not satisfied enough with the statistics in the paper. I would create new metrics to quantify players' value or how well they were doing. Now, my parents could have looked at that and said, that's not going to go well socially for Ty if he continues to, you know. But you learn as a kid, right? There's some things you have. They're a little quirky, and you're like, well, maybe I'll just keep this to myself for now, right? And so I did. But my folks didn't do that. They said, you know what? We're going to buy you this 5-volume set of books every year put out by this magazine called The Sporting News that is only baseball statistics. And I would sit there for hours on end. And this sounds like the most mindless, useless kind of activity to do, right? But I was passionate about it. I don't know why. I was just born with it. That's what I was passionate about. Now, did I become a statistician or a moneyball kind of guy as an adult? No. But them allowing me to nurture that interest and nurture that passion was really important, because what happened eventually is I became really interested in human behavior. I became really interested in really chaotic human behavior, like romantic relationships, or how people choose a partner, or why we're socially awkward. These are like really messy questions, right? And it turns out there's a lot of data about these things. There's like hundreds, thousands of studies about these things. And most people don't want to sit there with all those numbers and aggregate them into something, right, to find some sort of story. But that's exactly what I like to do. And so I think if people hadn't supported that when I was young, and if I hadn't been okay with that myself, you know, I probably wouldn't have ended up being in a position to do the things that I'm able to do now. And I get to do a lot of fun things now. But I guess in the broader context of our conversation, I'd just say, you kind of know, I think, a lot of times on some level, even if it's in some subliminal level, you kind of know some of the things you're really passionate about. But the problem is those don't always fit into a neat social category. And that's okay. That's all right. You don't got to know right away. But if you just be patient with it and don't give up on it. Just get really good at something. Just get really, really good at something. And then you'll find a way to apply that or to make that work.
If I could piggyback briefly off of what you said, which I thought is brilliant. The starting early thing applies to the arts as well. I think we tend to think of things like painting or novel writing or poetry as subjects that you really only get good at or begin to understand as an adult and even possibly late in adulthood. Whereas in fact, I think if you are passionate about visual arts or writing of some kind, whether it's fiction or nonfiction or poetry, you will be well served by treating it more like music, more like something that involves practice and starting out really bad and being okay with that. I talk to a lot of younger people who are interested in specifically careers in publishing, in writing in various forms, and they think, well, you know, I have this idea for a novel, but I don't know if I can do it. You know, I feel like I'm still too young. Write it anyway. Nobody, if you decide that it's terrible and you don't want anybody to see it, that's fine. Just throw it away. Delete it. It doesn't matter. What matters is the practice. The practice will help you in the arts the same way that they will help you in other more technical fields. So, you know, if you're 10 years old and you want to be a novelist someday, start writing your novel. It doesn't matter if it turns out terrible. It's really okay. I think it was Stephen King who said you have to write 50,000 crappy words before you can start writing a real book. So get those out of the way now. I'm serious. Mm-hmm. It's something that you do have to practice. The inspiration for art may come naturally, but the technical expertise does not. That comes with practice.
I'm going to take a different perspective on this slightly. I didn't know what I wanted to do for a real long time, and I still don't know what I want to do. At some point in my 20s, I realized I wanted to commit my life to social justice, but I didn't know what that meant. And I've gotten really lucky that the work that I do I'm able to do as a job, because it's not, this isn't, what I do is not like a normal thing that people do. You don't just usually start making videos and then become an organization. So I feel really lucky. And when people ask me, like, how do I do what you do? I don't really have a good answer for you. So you don't need to know what you want to do yet. Like, if you don't have a specific passion, that's okay, right? And that I've talked to a lot of people at this conference who are remarkable, incredible people who have changed careers like many, many times, or who went to school and got a degree in one thing and ended up doing a completely different thing. So, like, don't feel trapped into a thing at this moment in time. I will also say this, though, because this question was specifically about how do you turn your passion into a career. When you turn your passion into a career, it becomes work, right? Like, I love what I do, but it's work, man. And some days it sucks. You know, in games, it's very idealized to become a reviewer or work at a game site, and then you just get to play games all day. It is not as happy as it sounds, right? Like, you're lucky to have the job, and folks who have it really love it, but it's grueling at times. And so just understand that when you do take your passion or your hobbies and turn it into a job, it becomes work, and you have to sort of do that give and take. Kind of like what you were talking about with classes is like, what don't I like about this, and how, or like, what am I not good at, and how do I figure out how to weave that in? So sometimes hobbies can stay hobbies, and sometimes passions can stay passions. And then work can be different. And sometimes if you're really lucky, they come together, but do recognize that it becomes work, right? You have deadlines, you have things you have to write that you don't like, you have all kinds of stuff that comes with that. So just fulfilling my role as the downer.
So I think that relates very well to another audience question. We have a lot of students in the audience today, college students, high school students, and middle school and elementary students. So the question was, what piece of advice would you give to your younger self? The question specifically asked college or high school, but I'd like to open that up for even your elementary school self as well. What advice would you have that you wish you would have known back then?
I guess I have a pretty strong opinion about that. I don't think what I tell myself is, Ty, it's not so much what it is that you get involved with, it's who you get involved with, you know? I think so much of the pressure on your passion and not being bored is, what am I going to do? But at least for me, like, what I figured out is, like, no, like, the great learning I had and the great inspiration I had, it came from people, not from, like, institutions or things or topics, okay? Like, you just got to find people who speak your same language a little bit, right? Or passionate about the things you are and the way you are. Don't be too narrow, but, you know, find some of those folks. And more broadly, then, just find people who are interesting. Find people who are interesting and people who are interested in your development and your best interests. And those aren't always the same thing. So one practical thing I guess I could say about this is I listen to a certain podcast. These are part of my cliques. And I love was one podcast called The Nerdist. And all it is got this comedian, Chris Hardwick, and he sits there and he talks to really famous people like Will Ferrell and whoever else and says, how did you do this? You know, how did you get from a point to where you were a nobody and totally unsuccessful and everything else to a point where you're super successful now? And they just talk about their trajectories. And what you can glean from these conversations is a lot of commonalities about how people go about doing their work and get from point A to point B. So study people. Don't put so much pressure on yourself about the what or the things.
I would take I agree with everything you said, and that's actually a brilliant distinction to make. But for my own particular case, I would have told myself, study more math. I think, you know, as a kid, I was often told that I was smart. And like a lot of kids who were told that they were smart, I didn't want to get involved with something that would make me look less smart. And for me, that was math. And I failed to see, and this I think is part of this is how we teach math, I failed to see mathematics and numbers as a form of literacy, just like speaking and understanding and writing. I thought that it was just something that I was being tortured with, and why, and we all have calculators, and so who cares? And it's only now as an adult that a lot of the things that I'm interested in, I realize have some foundation in some mathematical principle or another, whether it's my ability to recognize how statistics are analyzed, is this a good study, is it a bunk study, I have no idea, or architecture, or time, or patterns, or any of these things. All of these have their roots in mathematical literacy. And now my foundation, because I neglected it, is so weak that I can't enjoy those things or understand those things in the way that I would like to. So if I had to go back, I would tell myself, yes, math is going to be one of those subjects in which you are bored, but everything is boring until you're good at it. And if you can sit through the boredom, you will discover that actually this subject is related to a lot of things that you do like and that you are passionate about. So, I mean, it's people tell me it's never too late, take an online course. And I'm like, yes, as soon as I get off Facebook.
I don't really have a good answer to that. I just went through my entire life as we were sitting here, and I feel like, you know, like I made really dumb mistakes and did stupid things, but like I wouldn't have listened. Right? Yeah. Like, that's the thing, is like I wouldn't have listened to any of my advice from this angle. And there's pieces of advice that I remember people giving me that I was like, whatever, like, you know, whatever. And then as an adult, I'm like, oh, I totally should have taken that advice. So some of it is like, I don't even know what to say because you're not going to listen anyways. Right. And that's okay. You know, and that will change too. Like right now, I'm really into working out. I know that's weird, but it's not weird. It's weird in my circles. And like, I was not physical. I hated sports. I was totally like a weird punk goth kid. I didn't stick with any activities when I was like much, much younger. So much so that my mom just enrolled me in the YMCA and was like, here, we'll just pay for one like year and you can do 50 things because I'm sick of buying equipment for stuff that you're going to stop doing, right? So part of me wishes that I stuck with something, like that I did something. But also, how are you going to tell a 6-year-old and a 7-year-old to like stick with something that they don't like necessarily? So again, I don't have a great answer to it other than you're just, it doesn't matter. Like the choices you make inform who you are and who you become, and you learn from them. And like someone on a panel earlier in this room talked about how like some of the most important things that they've learned in their life comes from their failures. Mm-hmm. And that's a little more dramatic than I meant to get to say, but that's kind of true, right? You do learn from those mistakes.
All right, we have about 2 more minutes left. So I'd love to hear some closing remarks about what it means to be young and bored today. And if you agree with the title of this panel, or if you have a different takeaway.
I don't want to go last because I'm not going to say anything profound. So I'm putting all the pressure on all of you. Because I don't have anything to say. I think this was one of my favorite panels of the whole conference, and it was the one I was most anxious about. Because I was like, what does this mean, and why am I being asked to speak for young people? And so like, I hope that you got something out of this. I think it's a really nice reminder that of we are not the young generation anymore. And like for a long time, my career was sort of predicated on being a young feminist. And so what role can we play in encouraging and supporting young people to not be young and bored, which I don't think that they are, but maybe we can help create space and pathways for them to take over the world.
It doesn't matter.
Anita and I are almost the same age, and sort of that exiting the coveted 18 to 34 demographic is bearing down on us really hard. And I think it's like I can feel it coming out in what I say, what I wear. I'm like, can I get away with this pink? I don't think I can anymore. So I've been trying to take the long view and be like, I'm not going to die at 35. Nothing magical is going to happen. But you know what? I think I'll just close with this, and I'm going to mess it up because I don't have it written down, but it's something I saw on a sign in one of the marches that have taken place in the last few months. And it was a play on sort of the pacifying message that I had heard growing up, which was, give me the strength to, how does it go? accept the things I cannot change. What was that? Somebody say it. Yeah. And the thing that I saw on the sign was, give me the strength to change, to not to accept the things that I cannot change, but to change the things I cannot accept. And if there is ever a two-sentence manifesto for the difference between the way it, what it means to be young now versus when I was a kid, it is that. So take that and go.
Tautologist, man.
I'll be super brief. I know we're running up against the end here, but I just say stay eager, you know? And if you're young, that's the whole reason I come out to this thing in the first place. It's just to be around people who are eager, you know? And that carries such value to people and to the world. So don't let people discourage that, you know? Stay eager, stay a little agitated. I think that's a great energy and a great quality that you bring to the world, and it'll take you good places.
All right, this panel has been young and bored of being young and bored. I would like to thank our panelists today. And I'd also like to thank Conference on World Affairs for allowing us to have these discussions. And thank you all for coming today.